I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go into the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
So, you're saying there's a chance. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the only unofficial UK Seahawks podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, as ever at this point, is joined by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. I've had a very good Christmas, apart from realising that I am still shit at Madden. I tried to play for the first time yesterday, and my God, am I horrific. Apart from like just launching it to Jimmy Graham at any opportunity, I am properly just horrific. And having to listen to Charles Davis tell me how bad I am, sort of the icing on the cake. So not a great time for me there. So efforts must be doubled, I think.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a smart plan, just throw it to Jimmy Graham.
I would do it all the time, yeah, but you know.
Yeah. And also, with Ross Bell out slaving away at his new job, we are joined by Nathan Ernst. How are we, sir?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Not too bad. The time difference is a bit of a killer for things like this, but what do you mean? Is it eight? You're in Seattle, are you? 8 hours behind?
Yeah, so pretty late for you guys.
Yeah. We're burning the midnight oil and all that.
Nothing like podcasting in the AM.
Yeah, so obviously we are rolling around to week 17, and with the Seahawks coming off the back of one of the most surprising outcomes. Adam, based on what we thought this time a week ago to where we stand right now, it was chalk and cheese, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm back to the point where I just don't really know if this team are good or not. I just can't work it out. But last week, as I said to you, I felt fairly just almost liberated. And actually, I think you tweeted about this, Nathan, during the Rams game, that like you sort of felt like you could almost take a deep breath and say, okay, that's just what we are and we're not great. But then they put in a performance like that. I mean, offensively was horrific, obviously. But defensively, it was almost a performance you could think you could almost ride something like that if you can get a few turnovers and maybe take that deep-ish against some teams. I don't know what you think about it, but I'm back to sort of the confused stage of what the hell is this team?
Yeah, the defense played really well, obviously. They've beat the Rams once before with a similar type of performance where defense played well, offense didn't play well. So, you know, that's who they'll likely face in the playoffs in the first round. And then you got, you know, a team like maybe they run into Philadelphia or a different team. You know, Philadelphia is missing Wentz. They've got Foles, and they already beat Philadelphia once. And so you can start to kind of trick yourself into picturing a run, but I'm kind of with you. I think you're tricking yourself. I really don't know how good this team is, but I'm pretty sure it's not that good. It wasn't bad, but it was kind of like, I thought I didn't care anymore. I thought I could just enjoy this.
Not so much. Yeah, it's kind of like you were okay making plans for week 17. Now you kind of have to shelve those plans to sit through another 3 hours of heart palpitations and all that.
And I'm sure this Cardinals game will be really, really easy. It won't be anything like last year's Cardinal game. No 6-6 tie. It'll be really stress-free.
Yeah. But it's going to be really frustrating for Rosie when I, you know, peel away from the midnight kiss to sort of watch Tyler Lockett not get an end-around going or something like that. I can just tell she's not going to be impressed by that, because obviously I think the game's a 4:25. Oh, actually, no, the game's a 4:25. No, it's a 1 o'clock start in Seattle, isn't it? So the end of the game is going to be right as the bell drops in London. So that's going to be just a complete disaster for me.
Yeah, I mean, if we could run the ball, the game will go quicker, as you've seen by some games this year. But obviously, we can't. So what were your thoughts, Nathan, on Sunday? Obviously, the defense really looked like the defense they have looked like in the past, when with Wagner and KJ Wright at the heart of most things, weren't they?
Yeah, it was kind of weird. For most of the first quarter, Dallas didn't really break any big runs, but I think they had, 50 yards rushing in the first the first quarter, and I was just waiting for that dam to break, and it didn't break, and they got better as the game went on, which, you know, kind of so much for the body blows crowd. But, yeah, so it ended up being really impressive. They held together really well. And yeah, this was more of a classic Seahawks game. The offense isn't usually quite that bad, but it was smothering defense and an offense that did enough.
Yeah. So on the defensive side of it, there is a lot of asterisks being flung around because of the O-line they come up against. But the pass rush, after a few weeks of dormancy almost, they played their part as well, didn't they? With Frank Clark and Sheldon Richardson and Michael Bennett.
Yeah, all those guys. Clark is playing really well for the most part right now. He's a ton of fun, and he got to get after Byron Bell a little bit, and so that was great. So yeah, the defense, they looked good. They looked legit. I mean, there are really no complaints on that side of the ball.
No, but the offense is a completely different question and situation and issue to deal with altogether, isn't it?
Unfortunately, what happened to this offense? I've been trying to figure this out. Like, this is the same offense that beat the Eagles. This is the same offense that went wild on the Texans, except they have Dwayne Brown now. Dwayne Brown switched sides. You know, this is an offense that went ballistic against the Jaguars, who are the best defense probably in the NFL, in the second half of that game. Like, I don't know. I have not been able to figure this out. I don't know if anyone has ideas. I mean, a lot of people point to the running game, and obviously that's a problem. But, like, where does this offense go, and where has it been? It's been a few weeks now.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
My worry with the offense is that, and, you know, please correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think they're getting worse. And that's the bit that worries me, that, you know, you would think that, yeah, even in the previous seasons when it's been fairly mediocre, you know, in the post-Lynch era, you know, obviously they developed an incredible passing game in 2015. Last year, they sort of managed to piece a little bit more together and gradually seem to be getting more and more into it. But right now, I'm looking at a team that just seem to be regressing, and the line seems to be getting more and more confused by the week. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about Tom Cable at some point today, because it's always interesting to get a fresh opinion on it in addition to us. And Bevel the same, but the thing that worries me is they just start to look more and more confused by the play. And I've said to you in the past, Stu, that you watch some of the sort of more polished teams, and they seem to just put together like actual plays, and we seem to put plays together that, like, if they just turned up from Sunday to Sunday and said, okay, we're going to run this, that's basically what they run. They don't look like they do a week of meetings and practices to actually put that in place, and that's what alarms me the most.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've watched – there was a lot of criticism of Russell. Obviously, the passing game was terrible, right? 60 yards. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievably bad. And so I've watched that Dallas tape over and over and over again. And, you know, I can't tell you a lot about what Russell did wrong. I don't really see him making mistakes or missing things. He wasn't perfect, but he wasn't bad by any stretch from what I can tell. Mm-hmm. And to me, the thing I just keep coming away with is it's the offense doesn't seem to have any purpose. Like, mm-hmm. I can't tell you how they're trying to attack, you know, the defense, or how they're trying to use the field, or, you know, how they're trying to blend plays together or anything like that. It's kind of like you said, they show up and Bevel picks up a playbook and they're like, all right, I guess we're running this and let's go.
It's like they just exist in order to get into a position where they can throw it to Jimmy Graham from a yard out for a touchdown. I mean, the only thing that I would say that has maybe, you know, markedly regressed, and I guess it's a bit of a luck shot anyway, but the deep ball from Wilson seems to have missed a lot more in the last four or five games than I can ever remember before. But you watch tape, and, you know, it's worth saying that one of the reasons we have Nathan on with us is that, and, you know, I don't want to blow too much smoke up your ass, but your tape study and the way you break down tape on Twitter is, for me, by far the best of anyone that does that. And Stu and I have said that in the past. And I don't know what your tape study suggests, but the deep ball seems a lot less accurate than it has been in the past in the last few weeks.
You know, I don't think he's hit a lot lately. I'm trying to remember that Jaguars game and how much he was able to hit downfield. I have a terrible memory. But I haven't noticed that so much. You know, last week he had the one ball to preach that was really nice, and Richardson just couldn't get his second foot down. And then went right back to him next play, not as great a ball. He had the one to Baldwin, where Baldwin, I think, got a little tangled up with the safety, and so ended up being overthrown. But Russell has had some... I mean, it's one of those where, you know, you're trying to throw a ball 40 yards downfield. It's tough to put it exactly where you want it. And Russell has always erred on the side of throwing long, right? Which is what you want to do. You throw short, you risk a pick, right? So I haven't noticed it much more than usual, but it's been something that has kind of floated around with Russ, where he'll kind of overthrow, and he's really best on those, like I said, that sideline route to Preach, where they were backed up against the end zone, and Preach just couldn't get his feet down. That's really his best deep ball.
Yeah.
When he's got guys that are, you know, behind the secondary, and he's just got to, like, chuck it, you tend to see a little bit more of an accuracy on those.
Yeah. And also, there is something you've been tweeting about with about the scheme as well, which it appears you covered on the Hawk Blogger live show last night, that you said that the Seahawks receivers are people who, and Doug Baldwin's admitted it today after his touchdown on Sunday, where they're better when they face man, but teams are throwing more zone coverage at them. Can you just quickly go through the differences and how they show that they're better at beating man in the out zone?
Yeah, I mean, they're not bad at zone by any stretch, and but their skill set, you know, Doug was talking about it, like you said, and the thing you said with, I just, you know, his mouth waters or whatever. He gets excited when he sees that corner come up and press, and, you know, in man coverage, and that's because his release is unreal. I mean, we saw that again last week. We see that every week, and good luck if you're going to try to press him. And, you know, he's so fast, and he can separate so well, and that's something that you're going to be able to use more to your advantage in a man-to-man situation, right, where you've got a guy that's trying to run with you. If you're going to try to come up and press and then press Doug and then run with Doug, you know, the next corner that can do it will probably be the first, right? I mean, he's unbelievable. Richardson is a similar type player. He's not Doug Baldwin, right, but he's real fast, and again, if you're going to try to run with Richardson, you're going to have problems. A healthy Lockett, if you try to run with him, good luck, right? So these are guys that they're just better off when they can just line up against somebody and just beat a guy. They're going to do that a lot. Now, when it comes to zone, you know, they're still fast, they're still quick, they can still sit down in zones. You know, it's not really a receiver issue. It doesn't play to their strengths, but it's not like it's a problem for them. But I do think that one of the fair criticisms of Russ is that he is much less comfortable throwing into holes, into zone, right? I had a big discussion with this about with Davis yesterday, because there was a one of the sacks that he took, not the really big one, but one of the ones earlier in the game.
About pick six or not. That was a good shout. I enjoyed
that. Pick
six
or not. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I'm sympathetic to Russ in those situations. I tend to think that people don't appreciate how fast DBs can break on a ball. But in fairness, you know, there's a chance that he catches that ball, right? There's a chance that he gets it out fast enough and the ball gets to Doug and he catches it and it's like a 7-yard gain, right? But Russell is not comfortable with that. He doesn't want to risk that. You know, if he sees defenders lurking, even if they're 5 yards away, right, if they're watching him, if they're lurking, he is not as comfortable trying to zip a ball into those spots. And so there's a lot of strengths for the receivers against man coverage, and then there's a little bit of a hesitancy from Russ against zone. And so you just see them perform a lot better usually against man.
Yeah,
I feel like I feel like I'm putting on my white sneakers and chewing gum and putting on my blue pajama Seahawk top and turning into full Pete Carroll mode here. But I mean, I fully agree that, you know, the reason we won on Sunday for me was we smashed them in the turnover battle. And I know it's a massive Carrollism, but I would always rather see Wilson, you know, not throw that ball than risk it, because I mean, the speed thing's a funny one, because I think I mentioned this to you yesterday when Stu and I were at the game, the Giants game this year. Stu, do you remember that McKissic run late in the fourth quarter?
Yeah.
And we just looked at each other and thought, these guys are just unbelievably fast. And it's just not a risk you want to take. And, you know, with the amount of players we have injured, you know, we say every week that if we're going to win against good teams, we have to play completely clean. And, you know, that's just not a risk I'm willing Wilson to take, to throw a little ball there that a DB could break on, because it's just not worth it.
Yeah, in that game situation for that yardage, like, I totally agree.
Yeah, and also with Wilson's lack of want to throw into open space, that's something me and you touched on with Jimmy Graham, and comparing him to the other tight ends we've seen with Wilson, is that he kind of seems to trust Graham more than any other receiver. Do you see that as well, Nathan? That he just, in tight spaces, Jimmy Graham is the guy he seems to trust more than others, or?
He's got a lot of trust, you know, when you've got guys that are one-on-one like that. I don't know. I mean, I think he's got a ton of trust for Paul Richardson. Yeah. We've seen that a lot. I wonder, I think at times he's had a lot of trust in Jimmy. I wonder if right now where that trust level is, just because we've seen Jimmy not really fight for some balls. We've seen some balls jump, you know, pop off Jimmy's hands, and go for picks and stuff like that. And so I wonder if he does have as much trust in Jimmy on those kinds of things. Yeah. But for the most part, I mean, look, I love Jermaine Kearse, but I mean, I'll admit he's not like the best receiver. And Russell had, you know, unending trust in Jermaine Kearse. I mean, it's possible that trust is a little bit of a fault with Russ sometimes, is that he will, he's a funny guy, because, you know, you talk about his hesitancy and stuff in zone and different stuff, and then you talk about how, like, sometimes he just trusts guys too much and he'll let guys go get a ball. He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, is that trust of, you mentioned Richardson and with Jimmy, is that something that could and maybe should put them at the top of the queue with them hitting the free agency market this year, or do you think that's a secondary consideration for them?
I mean, for me, if they're good with Richardson's medicals, Paul Richardson, not Sheldon, I'm great with bringing him back. Really, I mean, I would be shocked if he ends up getting around $9 or $10 million. I think that's high for him. But if that's where he ends up going at, I think if they're happy with his medicals, then yeah, I'm okay with that for Paul Richardson. For Jimmy, the age is an issue. I don't know how well he's going to age as a tight end. You know, there's only a couple guys like Gates and Gonzalez and a couple other that have really done well into their early 30s. And I just don't know why Jimmy would want to come back. Like, you know, he had so much success elsewhere. So I don't see Jimmy as much. I don't think one of the things that I've been talking about is, you know, I think when you start asking these questions about who do you want to pay, the question should be, can they be part of the next great Seahawks team, which is probably 2 years away?
Yeah.
I don't know if the answer is yes on Jimmy there.
No, that's fair. Adam?
No, I you know, we briefly discussed it on Sunday, I think, Nathan, with regards to Jimmy, because I probably was a little bit short-sighted in thinking, I just don't know how this team is going to get those 10 touchdowns back, you know, especially from tight end, where rookies in general don't have, you know, great NFL production. So that's a slight concern to me. But I guess you're right, that in the sense that, is it time when it comes to players that might not be first-tier but second-tier players that you just look and try and save the cap for 2019, which is the earliest that they can really make another run at opening up a big window?
I mean, I love Jimmy. I think he's great. I think he's probably gotten too much crap at times from fans and stuff.
Well, you're with friends here on that opinion, because we love him.
Yeah. And those 10 touchdowns are going to be difficult to make up, but there's probably a touchdown or two to be found in the running game.
Yeah.
To make up. You'd hope so.
hope that Russell doesn't have to score 99% of the touchdowns again next year. And you know, you can kind of see that happening pretty easily, even, because, I mean, assuming, I don't know if we want to talk about Kibble yet, assuming they get somebody knows how to run a run game. all of Jimmy's touchdowns have been, you know, within the 5-yard line, pretty much. It's not like a year or two ago where he was hitting some 20 and 30 yarders, right? And that's where you can see a running back, you know, start to maybe punch those in a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's address the massive Dumbo that appears to be looking at me in my living room and go on to Tom Cable. We, I think, are very much of the opinion that something has to change on offense. We're not geniuses. Something has to change. And that seems to be the most obvious thing when you look at players, teams like New England who changed their coach and a lot changed. And for me, I'm very much of the view that, let's say the line are performing currently at a 2 out of 10, I would risk 1 out of 10 to get 6 out of 10 with a new coach. That's currently where I am. And I think, Stu, you're probably with me on that.
Yeah, I've been there for about 18 months now.
Is that roughly where you are with it, Nathan? I mean, is it too obvious a thing to just say change Tom Cable, or is it just sometimes things are obvious for a reason?
Yeah, I think sometimes things are obvious for a reason. Does it solve all their problems? I mean, does it solve, the issue with last week, them not really seeming to have a purpose on offense? No. But offensive line, a very important position group. This running game can't get any worse. And so you can see a lot of improvements from that. And for me, though, it's just I don't know what more anyone wants to see from Tom Cable before they decide that he's not good. Mm-hmm. We can talk about the money that they spent now on the offensive line. For a while there, it was, they don't spend anything on the line. The line made $8 million combined. Well, that was true, but they were putting picks into the line.
Yeah.
He's had different prototypes of players, right? He's had the sparky, defensive tackle converts. He's had, he's had everything. And really, the majority of their rushing success, Marshawn Lynch is great, and I know that that's like a thing now that people are debating about Marshawn. But Russell Wilson was great, too, at running the ball. Russell Wilson did a ton to make that rushing offense so great. And when you go back to Cable's previous years in Atlanta, Michael Vick helped those rushing offenses a lot, too. Yeah. And so he's had some huge benefits. He's had some crutches to lean on. And he's still, at this point, struggling to create any kind of a running game. Yeah. And so I just don't know the argument could be for him anymore.
Yeah, but who was his quarterback when he was in Oakland?
He had a couple. He had DeMarcus.
That's it. Yeah. Well, he wasn't really much of anything, was he?
With
obviously all that with the O-line as well, he appears to have broken Dwayne Brown as well in about 6 weeks, which is... I mean, there was a play on Sunday where he appeared a petrified to sustain a block, and I think it resulted in a sack on Wilson, which is just... The amount of money and draft capital we put in, it's quite a worrying thing to happen so quickly, isn't it?
Brown's maybe getting a little too much criticism right now. I think overall he still played a good game against Dallas. But you're seeing some cracks in that wall now, and it's like he's only... I think it's fair to say he's only gotten worse since he got to Seattle.
Yeah.
And I just, not a surprise, really.
No. So obviously, alongside Cable, there's a lot more criticism readily available for Darrell Bevell. I said to Adam, if Bevell goes before Cable, then I think I might delete Twitter and Facebook for a few weeks on my phone, because I just don't see how that's the conclusion they jump to. But it's possibly as likely that we're in the final days of Bevell, or do you think he'll be able to survive another off season?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm not in any hurry to get rid of Bevell, but I won't be sorry to see him go either.
Okay.
I think that probably sums up as well.
Yeah.
I think we probably, we've seen enough good plays that you think that there's something there, but then ultimately the whole thing is such a train wreck that I'm almost of the view that if they just blew it up and started again, I don't think I could complain at that. I don't feel so tied that the only thing going wrong is lack of execution. We all complain about the conservative. I tweeted with 5 minutes to go, try and get to the 2 minute warning on this drive, and they didn't even get to 3 minutes. Do you know what I mean? There's just stuff that you think, I like Bevell, but if he wasn't there, it'll take me 5 minutes to get over it.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. And for me, while I have some criticism of Bevell and I'm getting closer and closer to being done with him, I do just wonder, how much of it is ultimately Pete?
Yeah.
He's got a way he wants to play football, and how much of what Bevell does is dictated by Pete's philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I do think that's a massive part of it. But do you think, with all the stuff that's going on in the NFC West, obviously Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan are hot names, hot and young coaches with offensive game plans. I mean, there's some plays from the Niners against the Jags where the Jags are barely set for more than a second before they snap the ball, just with all the pre-snap movement. Do you think that's something that may be accelerating their departures from the team, is accelerating the need for change in Seattle with the presence of those two?
I'd love to think so.
Yeah.
I mean, it when you watch those teams, it feels like they're playing a different, like, mm-hmm. evolution of football a little bit. I mean, it's still football and everything, right? They're not, like, too crazy, but they're operating on a totally different level. And hopefully, I mean, you know Pete's seeing it, right? I mean, yeah. He's studying tape on these guys and stuff, and so hopefully that gets in there, but who knows?
Yeah, Adam?
So I have, like, a bit of a bit that there's a – I don't know if you follow English soccer in any way, but there's a manager called Arsene Wenger who joined the team in 1996, revolutionized the game, revolutionized the sport pretty much, and won championships, titles, pretty much everything you could win. And then all of a sudden, the team started to catch up, and he's still playing in basically exactly the same style that he tried to in the early 2000s, and it's not really working anymore. Like, it's working to a degree. I guess the equivalent would be that it's working to a 10-6 level in the Premier League. You know, not that I'm trying to, you know, sort of make too many comparisons here, but I just wonder if Pete Carroll, you know, the NFL moves incredibly fast, and what you think is, you know, in vogue one year is very much not the next year. And I just wonder if, you know, Pete's a 66-year-old guy, and I just wonder if we're sort of getting to the stage where we now have a head coach whose style that he wants to play is becoming outdated, and to ask him to change at his age is difficult. So, you know, how long do we see that he can be in? I'm not advocating for a change at head coach, because that's like an easy thing to jump on, but I just wonder how sustainable his style is, you know, to win for a prolonged period of time anymore.
It's kind of funny though, because when he came in to Seattle at first, there were the same criticisms, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, he wants to run the ball. Like, you don't, it's a passing league. I mean, it's a passing league has been something that's been said for a long time now, right? And so yeah. Carroll was a bit of a throwback even when he first started in Seattle. And so I agree, and I have a lot of the same questions, like, is the game starting to pass him by and that kind of stuff. But I mean, he was successful. He won. I mean, he went to two Super Bowls. He won one, right? I mean,
sure.
With that rushing attack. And so I don't know if you can really say that he needs – how much he needs to adapt.
But how long does that – how much, you know, money in the bank does that give you? Because it's going to be four Super Bowls without the Seahawks soon, I think. Three or four. It's going to be three Super Bowls without the Seahawks getting anywhere near it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good question. I think that there are yeah, go ahead.
I mean, it's the same thing with Baltimore, isn't it? With Harbaugh. I mean, they won, was it five years ago, 6 years ago, and they've basically been 9-7 at best since. But no one seems to be putting any pressure on him because he has that ring. It's a similar situation, isn't it? With Carroll, obviously, with just a more...
It's a hard one because you immediately sound ungrateful having the conversation, but yeah. that gets to us. And it's the same with Schneider with the drafting, you know. At what point does the money in the bank and the credit run out?
Yeah, I mean, and there's the same criticisms of Tomlin and McCarthy too, right? Mm-hmm. All same type of things. You know, Belichick, how far did Belichick go between... He was making Super Bowls periodically. But he went how many years between a win?
2004 to 2014.
Yeah.
So he went 10 years.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is he should have won the two that he lost and lost the two that he won.
That's probably true.
Yeah. Yeah. And also there is the same thing with me, you mentioned Mike Tomlin, where they kind of seem to have had a few years of kind of battling to keep their quarterback upright, but now they seem well set after hitting on a few drafts. They now seem, I mean, they're 1 or 1A in the AFC, so that's something that's been pointed out that could be the Seahawks in the next couple of years. Do you see that as well, the comparison?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. This is a really interesting time right now. And they've whether they can win forever or not is going to be decided now.
Yeah.
All these teams, like we're talking about with Belichick, he went 10 years between win, right? He went a few years in between Super Bowl appearances. Tomlin, all those guys. You know, Tomlin's now turned that team over from a defensive team to an offensive juggernaut to now they're more of a defensive team again. Mm-hmm. And so all these teams change and evolve. Can Seattle do that now?
Yeah. I mean, also with Belichick, he's not – he doesn't seem to have any connection that Pete Carroll does on the defensive side of the ball because obviously they've traded – everyone pretty much apart from Dante Hightower the last few years, and that fits in with the ability to change, does it not, get locked in and take loyalty too far past the sell-by date kind of thing. Is that fair?
I think so. I don't know if you need to be that cutthroat.
No.
But I mean, that's definitely a stark contrast between how the two teams have been ran.
Yeah.
In terms of loyalty, we should probably get on to, you know, what I would probably consider in my 5 or 6 years of being on Seahawks Twitter as the greatest meltdown in its history. And that's the discussion that maybe Russell Wilson shouldn't be our quarterback anymore. I think it's probably the most preposterous thing I've ever read. And I'm very much of the view that, you know, teams win because of franchise quarterbacks, never, ever, you know, in spite of them, which seems to be of a narrative that's been built up. And I think you're on our side of the fence on this one, Nathan, but you know, give me anything that maybe suggests that I'm wrong on being so loyal to my quarterback who, you know, we probably wish we had forever.
No, I'm 100% on the same side as you. I see zero sense in it. I've heard several arguments now and they're all bad. they're all really awful. So I can't even play devil's advocate on this one.
No.
It's a terrible idea, and they shouldn't do it.
Yeah, there's like no comparison. I mean, me and Adam tried to think of one last week. There's no sporting comparison for a team to be in the situation where the Seahawks have been for the last 5-6 years to make the move that is suggested. That's that. I mean, the closest I could get was the Oilers trading Gretzky, but that was a bit longer into his career than Wilson is. It's just, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's the Alex Smith and Kaepernick thing, but that was different too. I mean, it seems to be born just from the idea of, well, this is what we did, or this is what the team did in 2012, and that worked.
Yeah.
That's what the team should do now. And which, okay, that completely ignores that not only was Russell on a rookie contract, you had a lot of the defenders on rookie contracts. Mm. You had Michael Bennett on a 1-year prove it deal, right? Yeah. I mean, Al
came Cliff.
In and was he was a Cliff got paid a little bit more, but was way undervalued in free agency that year. And so like there's just no sense to it. I don't understand any of the arguments that people are making for it.
No. Okay. Okay, well, not idiots, Stu. We've got that for us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we are idiots, obviously.
Yeah, I was going to say,
on that one,
part.
We're okay.
Yeah, we're doing all right on that one. So, obviously, one of the big things coming out from the game on Sunday, the Seahawks won 21-12, for people who maybe wait for us to say and may have somehow missed it since Sunday, was the Earl Thomas thing. And I mean, Adam, if you want to just throw the comparison, you think it's the football transfer at Nathan, but before that, but what do you make of all that? Is it a slight overreaction from outside parties, or is it something that just is not really on from Earl, Nathan?
I don't know. If you were mad about it, or if you freaked out about it like me because Earl's amazing and you don't want to lose him, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
If you freaked out about it because of some idea of loyalty, I think I don't know. That doesn't track with me very well. There's not a lot of loyalty in this business, and it's not like he just went up to any team and was like, hey, come get me, right? This is
his
childhood favorite team and all that. So yeah, I don't have anything against him there. I hope the Seahawks never trade him. I mean, he's amazing still,
but
no hard feelings beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, we had Marshawn Lynch for 4 or 5 years, and he had his hometown tattooed on his chest and no one seemed to notice. But Adam.
Yeah, I find it a difficult one. There's obviously no loyalty in the game, and of all the sports, this is one where, as he said, you know, when they kick me to the curb, I'll go elsewhere. I find it a fairly tricky one to stomach because it's not so often that you see a star player try and almost not force themselves out, but so openly discuss their future. And, you know, he said a few times on the radio interviews, you know, what my next team and whatnot. I think maybe I'm almost shocked to hear it as opposed to disappointed to hear it. But it strikes me as one of the few instances in the NFL where you've got a star player that might be angling for a move because he's not happy on his deal, and that there's almost, you know, a huge amount could come back, almost, you know, as we have in soccer, like the transfer fee that the other team would play. And I'm interested to see how it unfolds, because I don't think it's that common a situation for the league to be in with this.
And usually when you have a guy that does that, they don't last on the team very long. Mm. Like, usually when this stuff is happening, the divorce is soon, right? Yeah. But we saw it with Richard all off season, and he's still here. We'll see for how long. But
that seems more team-led than player-led.
Well, I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
I don't know which way that came from. I don't know if that was ever really clear.
Okay. Because for me, Earl seems the embodiment of Pete's defense. And if Pete had his way, he would probably be the guy that he would be his Russell Wilson, that he would carry through his whole career. Maybe, you know, Richard Sherman, you know, completely openly is him and Doug Baldwin are by far my two favorite players on the team. And so I always sort of felt like I was on his side and just desperate not for him to get traded. But to me, that felt like the kind of thing where it was convenient for the team to use his outburst to get him out. Whereas this seems like a reverse, but maybe you don't agree with me on that.
I don't know what spawned the whole Sherman thing. I mean, I don't know if it was one of those where he felt disrespected by the team, and so he asked to be traded, or if he didn't ask to be traded at all, or there were some people that were speculating that that the Seahawks were just talking about it just to humor him, and so that they could go out and say, oh, we're looking, and then, you know, not find anything, and then just keep him around and say, hey, we're sorry we tried. I really don't know what to make of all that, but I kind of get back to the, you know, usually when teams and players are so openly talking about that kind of thing, something happens. And so it was interesting not to see anything with Sherman, and it'll be interesting to see if, you know, maybe the same comes from this Earl thing. It'd be crazy if, you know, they just re-signed Cam, they paid money to Bennett, you know, they've paid some aging guys. It'd be crazy if one of the first guys from this, you know, old guard to go is Earl. He's obviously the guy with the most value, but, I mean, that would be kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, it does seem, me and Adam discussed the possibility of it trying to be with, obviously, the entering the 2018 draft with limited options, limited picks. It could be the clearest way where they kind of stock the cupboard kind of thing. Would you see that, or is it just not worth the rookie risk kind of thing with that, with Earl and the importance?
I mean, I get it. I mean, like I said, he's the one with the most value, and you could really see him getting, you know, kings or ransom or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, getting back to the Russ discussion, where they should trade Russ, you know, as long as you have Russ, like, this team's probably bad, but they're probably going to be 10-6. They might make the playoffs, like, and that's because you have a guy like Russ at quarterback. And so, while they probably won't be a great team for a couple years, they can still be a playoff team. And once you're a playoff team, single elimination and anything can happen. And so, like, I get the idea of flipping Earl to kind of cash in, and maybe they just aren't going to pay him what he is probably going to ask in a year, and so, you know, do it now, and that's all smart. But at the same time, it's like, you don't want to just, you're not going to just tank and do a total rebuild as long as you have Russell around.
No, yeah. I might say that to you, Adam, last week, where there's like a floor for this team, and it's higher than a lot of teams.
You almost can't have a full rebuild if you have a franchise quarterback. Like, it doesn't really lend itself as a natural situation to be in, unless you literally just put the quarterback out there with 52 other guys that have been washing cars for the last year. But yeah, so as we sort of come to the end of the Cowboys chat, you and people like Ben Baldwin and others who are well worth a follow, Nathan, have very much delved into the idea this year that running isn't actually that important at all in the NFL. I don't want to sort of be too reductive to your arguments, because they're actually much more developed than that, and Twitter is a terrible place to develop an argument. So this is probably quite a good place to do it. But I'm interested in sort of going into it in a bit more depth, because I maybe still, you know, sort of the old-fashioned view that running does open up things, but I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. And so sort of the floor's yours to sort of, if you can, just open up the argument slightly into what that is and what it's all been about this year, because it's been fascinating to read.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny because I started looking at all this and tweeting about it and writing about it, and because I thought running was important. I like the run game. I've spent a lot of time the last few years looking at the Seahawks offensive line and writing about that, and a big part of that was looking at the blocking. And I mean, my childhood team, my favorite team, was Super Bowl, running the hell out of the ball. Like, I have a big soft spot in my heart for running. But it's not that important, ultimately. What's really the simplest way to kind of break this down is, and you know, Brian was talking about this on the podcast last night, the Hawk Blogger podcast, and he said it better than I did probably. The worst quarterbacks average about 6 yards pass. The best running backs average about 5 yards a carry, maybe. Right? Alvin Kamara right now is averaging 6, and it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And the thing that gets you more yards is the better thing. And passing, just time and time again, gets you more yards. As bad as the Seahawks passing game was last Sunday, they passed for more yards than they ran for. which is fancy if you take into account the sacks and everything. You know, one of the things that really kicked this all off was Ben had been talking about, he'd been tracking the team with the better QBR in a game, which team mm-hmm. won. And it was something like 20 games in a row where the better team, 20 games for the Seahawks, where the better team, the team with the quarterback with the high QBR, so the team with the better QBR won the game. And he tweeted that all the way back to 2014. And if you look at which passer had the higher QBR, the team with the higher QBR is 69-1. There's that Arizona one in there. So, you know, just far and away, what decides who wins is your quarterback play. And so considering that what's important is your pass efficiency, and considering that you're it's hard to end up in a scenario where you end up running for more yards than you pass, and obviously getting yards and moving down the field and getting points is important, teams should probably run a whole lot less than they do. The times when they should run is when you are in short yardage. Seahawks fans wouldn't know this, but usually that's a good bet is running in short yardage. And then you'll bleed the clock in the game. Good teams run a lot, and it's usually because good teams lead at the end of the game that they're trying to run out. And so unless there's a situation where running makes sense, right, that you're not running for yards, so you should be running for some other thing, you shouldn't run. You shouldn't do it. And one of the other things that's interesting about it is that one of the common criticisms of this of the never run approach is that running helps passing. And there's been a lot of research into this, and it turned out that's just not really true. You know, how often the team runs, the balance, hit right balance, how often the team passes, how well a team runs, none of that stuff affects team passing efficiency, right? What affects your team's passing efficiency is basically how good your quarterback is, how good your offensive line is, right? That basic stuff. So, again, like, it doesn't help you get yards, doesn't help your pass game, it doesn't help you win outside of the block in the game. So teams are probably way over-rotated to running the ball.
Yeah.
So to devil's advocate it, and I actually don't necessarily disagree with you, off the top of my head, I'm thinking the Tennessee game where they just hammered us with the run after run after run after run. And eventually it worked to, you know, break off a couple of big runs, and then it also opened up a few big passes. Is the argument that actually those runs didn't open up the passes at all, and actually the runs, you know, eventually, you know, it's just as well that you ran for a big one because you wasted so many plays on running for short ones. Is that, would we come back to that, or is there any other argument to see where they basically to this run?
No, I mean, that's it. And, you know, the Dallas game is an interesting, you know, kind of counter to that Tennessee game, where Dallas ran really well early, and Zeke is a load. I mean, that dude, he hits. You know, last preseason, he just mm-hmm. bowled over Cam. Like, if you subscribe to the idea of body blows and that running wears down a defense, and that your 4 yard run in the first quarter is going to be a 5 or 6 or however many yard run in the fourth quarter, you know, that didn't hold up for the Cowboys. And when you look at it, I need to look at this a little bit more, but what I've looked at so far, there's not really much indication that teams run better later, right? That your 20th run is going to be significantly more, you're going to get significantly more yards on that 20th run than you are on your first or second or whatever run. And so this isn't really, there's I think there's a lot of confirmation bias and people see that stuff. And, you know, like that Tennessee game, like wasn't the DeMarco one like one of the very first plays of the third quarter for Tennessee?
Yeah.
I mean, we just scored and it was basically a comeback to after, did Process score a touchdown? Was it Carson?
I think it was Carson.
I don't remember who scored though. But anyways, that was fairly early in the game, all things considered, right? So I think there's a little confirmation bias when people look at that and argue that.
So with that, obviously you see teams like Washington who seem to have a different running back every week, but always seem to have a decent, well, average is probably their floor running game. But then you see teams like Jacksonville. Obviously, a lot of people are talking about Saquon Barkley this year. Do you see the Washington approach being the more fruitful and durable way to project him, or is my traffic just valid, or is there no real difference?
I mean, I think when you look at, you know, going back to Ben, who is the front runner on all this passing and running stuff, not in a bad way, the trailblazer, I should say, on this passing stuff, he's of the opinion that running backs don't matter. And I am not there 100% with him, but the idea that the running game is very important, and when you look just inside the running game, what's important there is your run blocking more than who your running back is. I think that's all true. And so if you're going to spend a high pick, I would much rather see you spend it on an offensive lineman who can help you run and pass than, you know, Zeke or Fournette or whoever else. And if you are going to spend a high pick on a running back, at least make it a McCaffrey type, which I think that was probably still a bad pick, but at least he is he gives you a lot in the passing game as well.
We will talk about how important the next few months or last years for free agency for Josh Snyder have not been fruitful. Is that something that is going to be another thing that's going to have to change in 2018? Obviously, they got some big ticket free agency recovered on the offense. They got Shadon Richardson. And a few other guys on the defensive side. I mean, the last couple of years with Luke Jokel, Eddie Lacy, Bradley Saud, and Jamarcus Webb, I mean, 2018 cannot be 3-3 for that, can it? For Don Snyder and the guys making the decisions.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be great if they could find somebody good. I think this offseason is going to be. I think the offseason is going to be more about who goes than who can. Like, it'd be about bloodletting than who they bring in, right?
Yeah.
Man, I don't think I'm expecting anyone in free agency that's like a big, big ticket, big money. I mean, even Luke Jokel at $8 million, I don't really see how they're going to be able to afford that if they want to keep any other guys around. I mean, just off the top of my head, can you think of anyone that really stands out? You know, even last year we were looking at, you know, TJ Lang, a running back of some sort. But right now, I imagine that they're sort of in a position where they need to save more money than spend.
Before we move on to previewing the Arizona game, just a quick few chapter notes. Tickets are still available for the 2018 UK Seahawks National Meet up in Bristol on May 19th, which is also now the day of the royal wedding, which is not going to be fun for people on public transport, I'd imagine. The tickets are £5. All the information is on the website at ukseahawks.com and on the Facebook page, UK Seattle Seahawks fans as well. We've got about 25 to 30 tickets left, so get involved. There's posters and all the information I have to pay there. But yeah, obviously week 17 is a few days away, New Year's Eve, which is for us Brits not very helpful because it, as I've mentioned, it kind of trickles into New Year's Day. The Seahawks return home for their home closer on the 2017 season against the Arizona Cardinals, aiming to finish off a 5-1 NFC West division run for 2017. Obviously, a lot has been made. All the Seahawks still somehow, with all the issues this team has faced in 2017, have a chance at making the playoffs. If the Seahawks win, then and the Falcons fail to beat the Carolina Panthers, and the Seahawks are in the playoffs yet again. Add on confidence for both those things to happen is what level on as we, what, 3-4 days
I'm fairly confident that we're going to win our game, because I think without Palmer, who has managed to just dice us way too many times at CenturyLink, to mention, and, you know, David Johnson, who last year had an incredible game against us, I think we've probably got too much in the locker, you know, to lose to Arizona, which is great sauce for me. and as for Saints, the Panthers against the Falcons, I don't know. I mean, it's, if the Falcons really need a performance, they've not had a good year by then, you know, what their expectations at all, and probably due a really big one. And that worries me. I do enjoy all the posturing that NFL players have to give of, oh, no, we won't be scoreboard watching at all. I mean, that's just dumb. Like, I don't understand how any humans can be wired like that. Very good. Like, I know it's the right thing to say in the media, like, oh, no, you know, we're just focusing on getting the W for us. But I don't see how that's possible. But, you know, good luck to them if they can do that. I guess what we have to hope is for Jameis Winston to have his first good game of the season and keep the Saints in it, so that the Panthers have to stay in it against the Falcons to sort of keep the Seahawks in it against the Cardinals, you know, without having too many domino effects. I don't know. I'm confident about the Seahawks winning, but I can't give you anything apart from that. I don't know if you have any more about Houston Heat on that one.
Nathan?
No, I'm mostly just terrified. I think I'm less confident about the Cardinals game. Arians with Hawken or whatever, and that one was a little hard because he wasn't wrong. You know, they've had some success up here, mm-hmm. So I'm nervous about that. But they are pretty banged up. I kind of think the Panthers are going to win, just because they're a weird up and down team, and I don't think that pretty much anything they do makes sense. And so I could see them winning that game, even though the Falcons are the ones they're ready to play for. But that's probably just hopeful to, you know.
It pisses me off that I'm emotionless again. I was completely fine after the Rams game. You know, when Todd Gurley runs for 1,700 yards for that touchdown to make it 30-0, I was totally fine. We're shit. It's over. Next year's coming on. That's fine. And now they give me hope again, and I'm pissed off because I was cool with where I was. I was cool with where I was. I'm gonna, you know, get myself ready for, like, you know, I'm gonna be in New York for the Super Bowl. I'm thinking about which bar I'm gonna watch during the Seahawks win the Super Bowl. And again, what the hell's going on? What's wrong with me?
That's a
well, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. We'll save that for the off season because there's way too much to talk about there.
It's annoying. I think spent all last week talking as well. Just Sunday we're having to enjoy another stressless week 17 game, but now it's just all kind of come back. I do think we'll beat the Panthers. I do think we'll beat the Cardinals. I think the Panthers could handily beat the Falcons, and it's just all about, I think it'll be a case of hopefully spending the fourth quarter seeing who we're going to play in the wild card, because there's all sorts of permutations, with the likeliest one appearing to be the Rams. But if the Seahawks are to win on Sunday, is it, Nathan, just a case of your offense showing more and then staying out their own way, as it seems to be more often than not with the Seahawks team, Nathan?
Probably. I'd love to see them do more. They've shown they do more. Yeah. But I think at this point, with what they've shown recently, it's more realistic to hope that they just, you know, don't shoot them in the foot and the defense.
It would be a very fitting way to end the season for us to lose this game and the Panthers to win, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Just the sort of tumultuous way the season's been up and down. Like, if you were ever going to underline sort of the, I know the end of the era stuff's a little bit overplayed, but if you were ever going to underline maybe a changing of the guard, it sort of would be going 4-4 at home with a loss that if you won, you'd be in the playoffs. So I don't know. I sort of just want Sunday to come and go, and then I just get on with the rest of my life.
Because they're like, if you start thinking about like playoffs without Seahawks,
yeah,
that rubbish, isn't it?
It's awful.
Yeah. I mean, I think 2008, I think, is the last year where the NFC playoffs had none of the Packers, Seahawks, and Cowboys in, and obviously if we lose on Sunday, that will happen with all those three teams in, which obviously it's been 6 straight years in the playoffs. Is it 7 out of 8 years playoffs Pete Carroll or something?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep, every year about 2011.
It will be strange, but obviously, as I put on my Facebook a few weeks ago, it'll be fun to do other things on Sunday nights in January.
But it won't actually be fun.
No, it won't be, but it'll be different. Different sometimes is good, just maybe not this time.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be annoying. But also, if the Seahawks win on Sunday, the Packers win, the Bucs win, and the Bears win, the Seahawks will face the Minnesota Vikings, and Blair Walsh will have a week in cold sweats.
Oh, man.
At that stage as well. So, if we can talk somewhat confidently, are you of the opinion it doesn't really matter who we play in the wild card, Nathan, or do you have a preference to see, or is it just get in the dance and go for it?
Well, now that you put out the scenario where they end up playing Minnesota, I think that's the most Seahawks, the most 2017 Seahawks way to end this year is to lose a playoff game to the Vikings on a missed Blair Walsh kick. Well, I'm kind of rooting for that, maybe. Not really. I mean, if they got to go out some way, that wouldn't be so bad. Aside from crazy Blair Walsh scenarios, I would not want to play Minnesota. I think they're the team that I'm the most afraid of. I would love to see them. Well, I'm kind of conflicted on that because I would like to see them in a dome, where maybe their offense can kind of get going and they can do some stuff there, because I still don't trust the Chiefs a ton. I mean, they're still a bit of a skeleton crew out there, and they've done a really admirable job, but I don't know if you can win playoff games with that defense. So, I don't know. It's all just a house of horrors. Like, do you want to try to watch Blair Walsh make a game-winning kick against the Vikings? Do you want to risk losing in L.A. to the Rams? There's a lot of ways.
That's the ultimate no. I cannot lose to Jared Goff.
Just quickly back on the Dallas game, they had on Sunday the drive, they had first and goal at the 3 and ended up missing a 40-yard field goal wide right. I mean, that is 27 Seahawks, isn't it, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, he missed two of those kicks.
Yeah, I mean, he's the most accurate kick in NFL history until Blair Walsh is in the building. They obviously had like a Freaky Friday moment or something before the game. But yeah, so, one to pinpoint on offense on Sunday, Adam?
I'm going to go with, and this is horribly shaped, but after Doug Baldwin screaming on the sidelines that he wants the something ball, he's my go-to guy. I've said a million times in this podcast that the Seahawks seem to be infinitely better the earlier they can get Baldwin involved in the passing game, and he sets the tempo, and he is the one guy that I really want to see involved, and it would be great if it is to be Jimmy's last game for him to haul in another touchdown in front of the home fans, because I think he's probably an underappreciated guy who probably deserves a nice send-off moment.
Yeah, it would be. Nathan, anyone that you want to see something from on Sunday on the offense?
I'll second the Jimmy Graham thing. There's been criticism of him being soft, and I think that's one that's kind of tough for him to shake. I mean, he's had moments where he hasn't swapped for balls, and he's had moments where he hasn't come up in big situations, and so it would be cool to see him kind of go off and maybe win them a game that gives them a chance to get into the playoffs. The other one, from maybe just more of a strategic perspective, it would be good to see J.D. McKissic really kind of get involved and do some stuff. He no-showed against Dallas. I don't think they were involved with his own. I don't really remember seeing him out there much. He didn't do much. I think he had one carry. And so it'd be cool if they got a little creative with him and got him involved.
I think he had like six snaps as well, something weird like that, which after a few weeks he's had, which is very strange. I think also with a running back, it's a case of seeing what is it a bit silly to put any weight on what they get from the running backs on Sunday or any playoff run moving into 2018, obviously with Thomas Rawls has kind of been the odd man out for most of the season. Mike Davis is showing flashes, and obviously Chris Carson may or may not be available for the playoffs. Do you think it'll be a bit silly to put any weight what happens on Sunday or any playoff run on the running back position?
Probably. Just because they've been so bad all year, I can't see them doing anything in one game that makes me feel like they've turned it around. It would seem fluky more than anything.
But I think it would be interesting to see what Thomas Rawls does on Sunday if he's active. Adam, defensive player.
I'm going to go with Jaron Reed. I think he has had a really, really good season for a generally unheralded position in an NFL team, and it would be really cool to see him get like a strip sack or cause a fumble with a huge hit on the quarterback, because I feel like he sort of deserves a big moment in the sun to sort of bookend a really great season from him, because he's a guy who I think his presence has been absolutely invaluable and very important to the way in which the team's played on defense this year.
Yeah, I think for me it'd be read, I think Greg Bishop from Sports Illustrated put a story up earlier today of Deion Jordan, and after reading that, you can only really have his back and get in his corner. So I think he'll be someone who's had, I think he's got 3 sacks in 4 games when he's played. So it'd be something that could make his contract a bit heavy in the off season. Anyone for on the defensive side, Nathan, for you?
Justin Coleman's been a playmaker. It'd be cool if he could keep that up. Yeah. You know, he's probably been the biggest playmaker in the secondary. As great as Earl is, he hasn't really come up with a lot. So I'd love to see Justin Coleman, you know, get another pick or even pick six or another sack. I mean, he's been everywhere, so it'd be cool to see him continue to ball out.
We did mention, Stu, that, you know, they and I don't know what the tape study's showing on this, Nathan, but whenever they seem to get creative with like a secondary blitz or something like that, it normally seems to work. It seems to have a really high level of success when they do try and be a little bit more interesting and, you know, send a guy that you wouldn't expect. You know, Shaq Griffin had a sack on Sunday. I think Coleman had at least one, maybe 2 sacks. It seems to work, whatever they dial up, but I sort of wish they'd do it a little bit more sometimes.
Yeah, and that goes back to, I don't know if you guys remember 2010. I think it was 2010. It was against the Bears, and, like, they sacked Jay Cutler a ton of times, and, like, Roy Lewis, cornerback, got, like, 3 sacks in that game. Like, they've done cool stuff with cornerback blitzes in the past, and it's kind of been, like, a not really talked about storyline this year. Where, yeah, they've gotten a lot of success out of those corner blitzes, so.
Yeah, also, with Justin Coleman, he's one of the 3 or 4 restricted free agents where they offer put a round tender on, and is it if a team matches, they give the team that level round pick? Is that how RFA works, Nathan?
Yeah, so they'll put whatever tender on, and then if they'll have an opportunity to match any contract, and then if they choose to not match, then they get that pick from the team that signs Coleman.
Yeah, so I think that's what happened with Gillisley in New England and Buffalo, wasn't it? Last year, they was off a 5th-round tender. And
yeah, Buffalo or Gillisley? New England's, I think, probably been the most aggressive team in RFA. I think that's how they got Welker, too, right? They gave up a 2nd-round pick for him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So, well, obviously, the Deion Jordan, Justin Coleman, Mike Davis, and Thomas Rawls are apparently the 4 restricted free agents. Do you see? I mean, Coleman's probably the likeliest to get a 2nd-round, 3rd-round tender, isn't he, of those 4? Or do you see Jordan or either any others?
What was the list one more time?
Deion Jordan, Justin Coleman, Mike Davis, and Thomas Rawls.
Yeah, I mean, Coleman's the guy that they'll probably do the most to protect, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
And they'll probably need to do the most to protect.
All right, this is Michael Sean Dugard, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast.
Before we wrap up, Adam, you got anyone to put in the proverbial bin?
Yeah, so what we do, Nathan, is we find someone in the NFL who deserves just to be placed into a hypothetical trash can for just disgraceful, you know, disgracing the league. So we've put, you know, entire teams in there before. And I think this week, I think he's been in there once with me before, but the way Hugh Jackson is being a sort of heralded and, you know, not hasn't lost his job yet, I find astonishing. And B, I feel the way he's treated DeShone Kizer, who may or may not be a good quarterback, but I don't think he's been given the chance to, just generally fairly outrageous. And so I'm putting Hugh Jackson in my proverbial bin / trash can. I don't want to see him ever again as a head coach, because he's got a smugness about him that I find really hard to stomach when I watch. And I'm not here for it. Sorry.
I don't have any.
He's been
good.
No.
Oh, yeah. I don't have any problem with that, but Hugh Jackson did have an amazing moment this week when he was asked about his job security, and he's gotten a vote of no confidence, or he's got a vote of confidence from Haslam recently, and so he had some line about how, I don't have any reason to think that Jimmy Haslam is a liar when he says my job is safe.
I saw that.
Which I thought was pretty spectacular. So Hugh Jackson belongs in the bin for sure, but that was a great moment.
Yeah, for me, I think the NFL office in New York should go should be put in the proverbial bin after, is it Calvin Benjamin, wasn't given a touchdown catch in New England. There's an amazing sound effect from the game. I think McDermott asks a referee how it's been overturned, and the referee just turns around and goes, I don't know. I mean, the fact that they're not supporting their referees, it is a touchdown catch. Don't overcomplicate it. It's just, after the few weeks we had, we saw one the other week. I know he didn't stand upright, but Jimmy Graham took 6 steps. Albeit, as I said, not upright, and it was not what wasn't labelled as a catch, although it pretty blatantly was. In cricket, it's a catch. But yeah, I think the NFL office would, just how they're just completely muddy in the waters with what a catch is and isn't. And Calvin Benjamin's the latest victim of that, Adam.
Yeah, and it's especially annoying because both have come against the Patriots, so that sort of proliferates the narrative that there's some league bias for the Patriots, which there may or may well not be, but it just is two complete perfect storms with the Jesse James and now the Calvin Benjamin one. Yeah. You're a bit on the spot here, Nathan, but is there anyone in the league that's just pissed you off? And this is your one chance. Your one chance of the week that you can banish them from memory for 1 week and 1 week only.
I'll take an easy one and I'll banish him from my memory 1 week early and put Arians in the bin.
Nice.
Happy trails to that dude. I'm so tired of hearing him. He's mediocre, and I said it on the Hawk Blogger podcast. He's barely even a footnote in this era of the NFC West, and he can go ahead and just mosey along already.
Well, we might need a slightly larger bin for him than Hugh Jackson, so we can pull someone more industrial for him without wanting to offend him too much.
Yeah. I mean, he's Bruce Arians is almost Chuck Pagano in how he's wasted that team and the talent they apparently have, hasn't he, Bruce Arians? I mean, I know so much of it is, again, based on the quarterback's health, but Patrick Peterson, Tyrann Mathieu, Chandler Jones, Calais Campbell up until this year, he had the best running back in the league in David Johnson last year. He's had Larry Fitzgerald for pretty much every game, every snap, and yet they've kind of not done a thing. And obviously we took behind the Colts, wasting and ruining and breaking forevermore Andrew Luck. It's kind of apt that Arians is now getting talked about for being the Colts' possible coach in 2018, Nathan.
Is he really? I hadn't even heard that.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Apparently.
I mean, whatever. Poor Larry Fitzgerald is what I'll say. That dude has put up with... I mean, he had the Super Bowl, so he got a... You know, I mean, he didn't win, but for the most part, that guy has put up with nothing but horrible coaches and horrible quarterbacks, and now he's putting up with Bruce Arians, who by all accounts seems like just a crappy dude. So whatever the opposite of putting someone in the bin is what I want to do for Larry Fitzgerald.
Yes, if you want to get involved with the podcast, you can via all the usual means on thepedestrianpodcast.podbean.com, on Instagram, the Pedestrian Podcast, on Twitter. The chapter is Seahawkers at Seahawkers UK. Personal ones is at Stu_Core, at RossBell1984, and at Adam the Nathan. Facebook page, as I said, with all the information for the national meet in 2018, May 19th, 2018 in Bristol, is UK Seattle Seahawks fans. Nathan, obviously you're, as me and Adam said numerous times to each other and to you during this pod, you are our go-to when we want to have film breakdowns and just become a bit smarter about the Seahawks, about the game we just watched a few days earlier. Where can people catch your work on Twitter and obviously all the Hawk Blogger stuff as well?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, NathanE11. You can find everything there. If I write stuff, I tweet it out. So that's the spot.
Yeah, cool. Massive thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us, two Brits, and obviously, as we said, making us seem a bit smarter than we probably are.
No, I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
So this is all we have for the Pedestrian Podcast this week. We will be back next week, obviously, maybe with a playoff one, but more also just as likely with a season wrap up. Until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks and Panthers.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
That is going to do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks Super Bowl 48 champions.